Do you feel a shiver up your spine from fear? Yes, it's another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind. Amp up your imagination and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted. True Stories of Animal Ghosts, introduced by Ma F.C. Folks. The question as to the existence of animal ghosts creates a wide field of speculative argument, but the belief that faithful and loving dumb friends do not meet with total extinction and death is very consoling to animal lovers, who find this aspect of companionship more satisfactory than the possession of uncongenial friends and relations. I do not include in this category dog and cat owners, who spoil unfortunate creatures by that false kindness which destroys all vigor of both mind and body, or the hysterical women who kiss the sweet little noses of their pets regardless of what that inquisitive little nose may have previously sampled during its walks abroad. These people do not and never will understand animal mentality. The individuals who welcome returns treat animals sanely and humanely, and the fact of future compensation to animals worn out in the service of man is very comforting. In connection with a belief in returns, I always remember the words of a small child when he saw a pitiful little stray lying dead in the gutter. "Never mind, pussy," he said as he bent down and smoothed the draggled fur. "In heaven, all the cats have golden tails." Some of our greatest poets have believed in animal survival, and which of us does not know Pope's beautiful lines? Lo, the poor Indian whose untutored mind sees God in clouds or hears him in the wind, his soul proud signs never taught to stray far as the solar walk or Milky Way. Yet simpler nature to his hope has given, behind the cloud topped hill, a humbler heaven. But thinks admitted to that equal sky, his faithful dog shall bear him company. Unfortunately, the majority who have received proofs of animal survivals usually hesitate for fear of ridicule to discuss them. They are, however, well-known and well-authenticated hauntings, notably the strange case of Balanchine House, Perthshire, a record of which was published in 1900, when the wealthy family who rented it left precipitately after a tenancy of barely 7 weeks. The late Marquis of Bute, a member of the Psychical Research Society, was keenly interested in psychic phenomena, rented Balanchine House with the owner's consent in order to investigate the hauntings in collaboration with Major Les Mesurier Taylor and some other members of the society. The manifestations first began in 1876, and shortly before his death, Major Stewart, the then owner of the property, a great dog lover, insisted that he would return to Balanchine in the body of his favorite black spaniel. Evidently, his heirs did not wish to renew his acquaintance in doggy form, so the spaniel and 14 other dogs were shot immediately after the major's funeral. The removal of the dogs resulted in their ghost invading Balanchine, especially the library, where Major Stewart's niece felt herself pushed aside by them, and a visitor saw a black spaniel run across the room, greeted with evident pleasure by his own dog. Sounds of dogs' feet and the noise of tail wagging on doors and woodwork were common occurrences. Real dogs would often be seen watching the movements of other dogs invisible to humans. And one night, a lady awakened by the uneasiness of a pet dog who slept on her bed actually saw two black paws on the table beside her. The story of Balanchine House became common property in 1897 when the Times published a lengthy correspondence concerning the hauntings, corroborated by independent and reliable witnesses. There are many other stories of ghostly dogs. In Ireland, the belief in the black dog is widespread, and one particular bedroom at a farm in County Tyrone is haunted by a huge black dog seen by people who have slept there. And at Rathfarnham, the ghost of a dog who tried to rescue his master from drowning is said to haunt the road between Rathfarnham Castle and a bridge lower down. Incidentally, a monument was erected in 1841 to commemorate the dog's devotion. But like sentimentalities of this description, it has gone the way of most pretty things, and only a fragment of the pedestal remains. True ghost stories of cats are few and far between, so cat lovers in general and those who remember seeing Village Schmoneveen and Fairy Flax at important cat shows will welcome the description of their after-death returns contributed by their owner, Miss Thistle Cochrane. Miss Cochrane, a daughter of the late Colonel Cochrane, lived for some years with her mother, brother, and sister in a delightful old house at Whitehead's Grove, Chelsea, now, alas, swept away by the invasion of flats. And number 29 was run by Miss Cochrane as a nursing home for animals in conjunction with the late Mr. Alfred Sewell, veterinary surgeon to King Edward VII and His Late Majesty King George V. Mr. Sewell's clientele included royal, aristocratic, and distinguished names, so the nursing home in Chelsea represented the class of patients in the animal world that Almina, Countess of Carnarvon's nursing home, represents in Mayfair. In fact, a new arrival might easily have been challenged by the other canine patients as to his owner's social position, in the words described on the collar of a dog belonging to Frederick, Prince of Wales. "I am His Highness's dog at Kew. Pray tell me, sir, whose dog are you?" It was a charming place. The wards were airy, clean, and flower-filled like those of a hospital. There was also accommodation for private cases, and as Prince of Wales, His Majesty's Cairn Cora was one of them. How well Miss Cochrane remembers the prince's charming informal visits, and his appreciation of her attention and care of the proud mother and her puppies in a personal letter written after he left London for Sandringham. It is sad to think that not a vestige of the old house, which I always looked on as my real home, remains. In the garden, an ancient mulberry tree was laden in summer with purple-red fruit, and a vine luxuriated over the windows along the balcony at the back of the house. How excited we were when the little bunches of green grapes ripened, and how pretty the vine became in early autumn, when its leaves blazed with crimson and orange. Mass lilac trees in the front garden hid the exterior of the house from those who passed by, and the dear mother, even when she was slowly and painfully dying, never allowed any gloom or sadness to spoil the happy atmosphere in the shady rooms, full of associations with the family's distinguished military and naval record, where old china, miniatures, and pictures featured the colorful past. Both Thistle Cochrane and her sister Barbara are great cat lovers, and the former would not allow these stories to appear under her name unless she was convinced they were absolutely true. The following is Miss Cochrane's contribution. The Return of Village Schmoneveen and the Fairy Flax, contributed by Miss Thistle Cochrane. Village Schmoneveen, the first of my two returns, was brought from the Isle of Man as a tiny snowflake of a kitten. Even then we recognized that the snowflake possessed remarkable points, but she did not appeal to me as a possible winning investment. I loved her for her helpless, adorable tail itself, and I had no idea of her future sensational show career, when she won 11 championships, innumerable firsts, and a plethora of silver cups during her short life. Whenever Mona appeared at shows, her pen was surrounded by admirers, and always delightfully self-possessed, she accepted the adulation she received at her due, although in private life she was just a very simple, affectionate cat, without a vestige of side in her makeup. She shared our lives for 6 years. Then one day in April, she was taken suddenly ill. I nursed Mona, sitting up for 3 nights in a little room set apart, and anyone who has watched an animal suffer will understand my feelings in the long hours when I fought death and at last realized I couldn't save her. With sick babies, very young children, and animals, what most stabs the heart is their inability to tell you how they feel. They can only look or cry, and at last you dare not read the muted suffering that finds an outlet in their eyes. Strange that the physical ailments of old age do not usually meet with a sympathetic response given to those of the young, but perhaps old people protest too much. As I watched Mona and stroked the tormented little body, I thought of her, only a week ago serene and beautiful, and I wept for the pity of it all, the waste of a happy life and the loss of her friendliness, as I'm sure she felt genuine pleasure whenever she won prizes for her dear aunts. We were always aunts to our animals. Tomorrow there would be no Mona, and I should repeat the same untruth. I'll never have another cat, only to fall for some cuddlesome bundle of fluff, rose thorn claws, and what a dear old lady used to call velvet paws. Then Mona died. Afterwards, habit, such a factor in my workday life, asserted itself. I looked at my watch, past midnight. At 6 o'clock, our daily round would recommence. Almost mechanically, I began to tidy up. I shouldn't have time later. I left the snowdrift that had once been the kitten's snowflake lying peacefully in her basket. I put medicine and dressings back in their place and rearranged the sickening paraphernalia of illness. I sat down by the open window. The little wind that runs before the dawn was early astir. The garden was fast asleep, and I wondered whether, as the scriptures say, God gives his dumb creatures a glorious liberty. If only poor little Mona were happy in this freedom. As if in answer to my question, I heard her familiar purr close beside me. I couldn't possibly mistake her song with its throaty cadence, its joyous gurgles, and I knew she wanted to say, "Dear aunt, it's all right, don't worry." Afterwards, the room was quiet again. This actually happened. It was no question of imagination, and I'm convinced that a compassionate God allowed Mona to return and heal a little of the pain which results in loving humans or animals overmuch. Directly, it became known that Villish Mona Veen was dead. The authorities at the South Kensington Museum asked me to allow them to have her body stuffed in order to exhibit it in the natural history section as a specimen of the perfect tailless Manx cat. So today, Mona looks at life from a single angle. For some time, I was strong in my determination not to own another cat. But one afternoon, my good intentions added other paving stones to a well-known road. When I saw White Kitten in the animal department at Selfridge's pleading to be bought, I could not resist the appeal of the bluest eyes imaginable, so I brought her back to 29, and remembering the lines, blew her eyes like the fairy flax, I christened her Fairy Flax. Fairy Flax was the sweetest kitten, and the mantle of Mona's past triumphs fell on her. She swept the board at her debut in the show world with 10 firsts and many specials. But Fairy Flax died of an epidemic of gastric influenza, which devastated the cat world. And during her illness, I nursed her in my bedroom, where she lived and slept with me. We loved Mona, but this blue-eyed creature was in many ways more human than the champion. Fairy Flax loved to frolic. She jumped through an invisible hoop like a circus star. It was impossible to feel lonely where she was. Thus, the miss of her at times was unspeakable, although during the day, every hour had its appointed tasks. The third night after her death, Fairy Flax returned. I state this quite seriously, not as a morbid hallucination, and the conviction that this really happened enables me to face possible ridicule or adverse criticism with complete indifference. I was lying awake, a nightlight burned on a nearby table, when suddenly there was a rushing gleam of white. Something sprang on the bed and nestled down in the usual place. It was Fairy Flax. For one moment she was real, then she was gone. She never came again, but I think, like Mona, she was anxious to let dear aunt know that all was well with her. A Maltese dog from the other world, The Curse of Pasht, contributed by Miss Thistle Cochran. Maud Folk's account of 29 has recalled two strange occurrences, one connected with our mother, the other with the revenge of Pasht, the cat goddess, which are not without interest, although strictly speaking, they cannot be classed as ghost stories. Sometime after our mother's passing away, my sister Barbara went to a private seance where the well-known Mr. Van Gogh was a medium. And Barbara's astonishment may be imagined when he described Mama exactly as she had been during her last illness. And more extraordinary still, he was correct in quite trivial details. We had always insisted upon Mama looking what we called beautiful. It helped us in those sad days to go into her bedroom and admire her embodied daintiness, and one of our especial duties was to arrange her still lovely hair in two plaits and tie it with little ribbon bows. This was especially commented on by Mr. Van Gogh, who also said that Mama was holding a white Maltese poodle in her arms. The curious part of this statement, the truth of which could not have been known by the medium, is that Mama's one-time inseparable companion was this identical little dog, Zoe, given to her when she was staying in Malta by the Aunt Selina, Mrs. Brownlow, who is shown with the dog in the illustration. We have never been able to explain this, but I give it as another instance of animal returns. The story of Pasht, the Egyptian cat goddess, concerns a small, faint figure discovered in a mummy case brought to England by Algernon Blackwood for the friend we call the Third Sister, who, thinking an animal's nursing home was a sympathetic environment, presented Posh to 29 as a luck bringer. We put the cat goddess inside a cabinet, and it never occurred to us to attribute the subsequent disasters to her influence. But inexplicable things happened. Patients hitherto well on the road to recovery died, and nearly every morning saw another vacant cubicle. Mr. Sewell was as puzzled and worried as ourselves, but the climax came when a perfectly good sash cord broke just as I was opening the window, which promptly descended on my head and hurt me more than considerably. The same afternoon, Miss Withers, an old friend, came to tea, and my damaged condition led to mentioning the sudden deaths which would soon destroy 29's reputation as a place of healing. "You must have something unlucky in the house to account for this," decided Miss Withers. We assured her that it was not so, and then Barbara remembered the cat goddess. "But she is connected with animals, so surely she wouldn't hurt them," said Barbara. Miss Withers listened and asked us for the loan of Posh. A day or two later, she came back, all excitement. "My dears, I'm convinced the troubles are due to this horrible figure. For goodness sake, do away with it." She went on to explain that she had taken Posh to the British Museum, where she happened to know someone in high places, referred by him to a learned member of the Egyptian section, to whom she related the story of 29. Miss Withers was informed that although Posh was an animal deity, her image was never placed anywhere in direct contact with them in the past. As if so, the goddess destroyed life at once. After hearing this, we were weak enough to have Posh, who has green barrels for her eyes, buried secretly at night, somewhere in Chelsea, and call it coincidence if you like. Next morning, we resumed our nursing with no outside interference. The elemental on the church steps at Fiesole, contributed by Bod Fox. Students of psychic phenomena place certain manifestations, usually to be met with in localities possessing remains of an ancient civilization, as elemental, and I am inclined to believe this theory, as I once saw a most extraordinary elemental when I was staying at Fiesole as the guest of the ex-crown princess of Saxony. Fiesole, one of the loveliest gems in the nature crown of Italy, was originally the Etruscan town of Fazula, and the ancient houses and palazzos are built above the foundations of buildings destroyed by Sulla in 82 BC. I have been told that weird happenings were frequent in the neighborhood, and if my bedroom in the little Hotel Aurora could have spoken, it would have yielded copy for another true ghost story. But I only heard occasional sobbing near the window. Nothing ever materialized, so it was evidently decreed that I was to encounter my ghost, or rather, elemental, outside. The ex-crown princess's villa was barely 10 minutes' walk from the hotel, but we thought it better for both of us as collaborators if I went back to the hotel every evening and came to the villa in the morning, ready to work after the mental rest represented by a complete change of environment. We usually finished our collaboration for the day about 6 o'clock, and I dined in my room at the Aurora afterwards, reading or writing letters until it was time for bed. Sometimes I stayed to dinner at the villa, and one night the princess declared that I must take a walk with her husband, Enrico Toselli, and see Fiesole by moonlight. "It's quite wonderful," she said. "You've no idea of the glamour of moonlight until you look down on Florence. The cypresses are like black plumes against a night blue velvet background, and I'm sure you've never seen such stars in England." She was right. Even the Via Pagnucci, by day the ugly conception of an Art Nouveau architect, became romantic, and the steep, rough road leading to it looked like a silver stream, as Enrico Toselli and I walked down towards the piazza. Not a soul was stirring. Fiesole might well have been uninhabited, so we planned to walk up the Via San Francesco to the top of the West Hill, from where one is able to look across the valley towards Florence, bounded by ranges of hills and Monte Albano. At the church of Santa Maria Primerano, I noticed a large, dark object lying halfway up the steps. "Whatever can that be?" I said. "Most probably it's a sheepdog from the hills," replied Enrico Toselli. "But it doesn't look like a dog," I persisted. "It's much too large." "The effect of Luisa's glamorous moon? Perhaps it's a calf. How does that fit in, signora?" At that moment the thing moved and stretched itself like a spreading ink stain on the moon base steps. I have never seen such a sight before or since. The thing was black, much bigger than a calf, with an enormous head. Its eyes shone like twin emeralds, its jaw slavered. One felt instinctively that it did not belong to this earth. We watched the thing amble leisurely down the steps until it reached the level of the ground, when its pace changed into a stiff gallop until it finally slooped up the hill. And I remember how its long, whip-like tail lashed the air from side to side. "I don't think we'll go any further," I said, for to be perfectly honest, I was well and truly frightened, and I had not the slightest wish to become better acquainted with the thing. Enrico Toselli agreed with me. Once inside the hotel, I ran up to my bedroom, but I was too nervous to go on the balcony and gaze at stars, which, according to the princess, didn't exist in England. I dreaded lest I should see something streaking silently across the sleeping landscape. So, closing the jalousies and shutting out the night, I undressed and got into bed. Next morning, I made tentative inquiries, and my reputation of being simpatica helped me to find out what shapes or things, animals, yet not animals, were often seen by people returning late at night from some distant village or by shepherds moving their flocks from pasture to pasture in the summertime. "These creatures are certainly from purgatory," said my informant. And after years, I learned that certain animal elementals are common on the Roman Campania, and certain localities in Rome are definitely haunted by the returns of dogs and cats, notably outside the church of San Giovanni de Collato and the famous Bocca della Veritas. But the accounts of what is seen inside the Colosseum at the fall of the year are best left hidden in the mists which rise from the blood-saturated soil. According to reliable witnesses, the ghosts of the wild beasts, especially in the underground passages where they were once caged, are horrors which should remain unsought and undisturbed by even the most fearless ghost seers. So much for Italian elementals. And I will conclude my stories of returns with an account of the psychic phenomena of the ape-man. The ape-man who haunts an Irish castle, by courtesy of the Reverend Archdeacon St. John de Seymour. The truth of the story was vouched for to Mr. Reynolds Spann by the vicar of the Anglican Church, Arizona, as it happened to some friends of his when they once rented a picturesque castle in the south of Ireland. The visitors from the USA were delighted with the castle and its beautiful grounds. There were certainly rumors not calculated to make the nervous less nervous, but the enthusiastic tenants put down everything out of the ordinary to the imagination of the villagers, and perhaps they were secretly pleased to find they were living in a house of traditions. One night, Mrs. A. was sitting by her bedroom fire expecting her husband to return from Dublin, when the stillness was shattered by the loud banging of a door in the corridor, followed by stealthy footsteps creeping and crawling about in a very peculiar manner. Mrs. A., neither nervous nor imaginative, opened her bedroom door and hurried outside. At first she saw nothing. Afterwards, as she stood holding her lighted candle above her head to get a better view, she noticed an extraordinary figure shambling in the direction of the staircase. Before she had time to wonder who on all the earth was roaming around, the creature turned and looked at her, and Mrs. A. saw what appeared to be a hideous human face on the body of a huge ape. The revolting creature stared at the frightened woman for a few seconds and then vanished. Mrs. A. ran back to her bedroom, shrieking as she ran, and one of her daughters, awakened by the noise, tried to calm her mother by assuring her that the ape was nothing but a waking nightmare. Knowing how futile it is to argue with certain mentalities, Mrs. A. did not enter into a discussion on nightmares. Neither did she confide in her husband, and a few nights later Mr. A. experienced the supernatural without any suspicion of undue influence. When he was coming upstairs from the entrance hall, where he had been smoking and reading long after everyone else had gone to bed, all at once he heard a queer kind of laugh, and looking up at the landing, he saw an ungainly figure leaning over the banisters. The obscene face, of a leprous whiteness, was that of a clean-shaven youngish man, and its expression was not only evil, but horrible. As the creature looked at Mr. A., Its body positively shook with laughter, and Mr. A noticed that the hands and arms resting on the banister and rails, covered with thick reddish brown hair, were those of an ape. Mr. A rushed up the stairs, a proceeding which seemed to appeal to the ape's sense of humor, as it laughed so loudly and continuously that the rest of the family hurried out of their bedrooms to see what on earth was happening. After their father had described his meeting with the ape man, Mrs. A told him exactly what she had seen a few nights previously, adding, presumably for her daughter's benefit, "So, as your father has seen what I did, it couldn't have been a nightmare." Next morning, the A's made a thorough search of all the rooms in the castle. The servants who occupied the kitchen wing had heard and seen nothing, so the A's kept them in ignorance, and although the search yielded no result, they decided not to relinquish their tenancy, but to keep a sharp lookout, and if the ape man appeared again, to shoot at sight. Nothing further happened beyond queer sounds in the small hours, stealthy footsteps, stifled cries, and door banging, unaccountable but not tremendously hair-raising. However, the A's had not long to wait for the inevitable climax, which caused them to leave the castle and return hot foot to the USA. One afternoon, Miss A was in the drawing room, arranging the flowers, certainly not giving a moment's thought to noises or apparitions, when all at once she heard a rustle behind her and felt two hands on her shoulders. Thinking the hands were those of a girl staying at the castle, Miss A turned and found herself face to face with a loathsome object, chuckling at her discomfiture. The daylight showed the creature to be neither human nor animal. It was covered with hair like a gorilla. It stood over 6 feet high, and its appearance was so repulsive that Miss A, overcome with disgust, called loudly for help. But just as her friend came to the rescue, the ape man vanished, although not before the other girl had caught a glimpse of the horror it represented. After this, the A's thought it better not to risk any further manifestations, and they returned to America, leaving the picturesque castle once more to be let furnished. Two Ghost Stories of St. Albans, contributed by Mrs. Butt of Sholdean Hall. The Doctor's Ghost. Mrs. Butt of Sholdean Hall, Deal, who contributes these first-hand psychic experiences, lives in a haunted house, the ghostly return being that of an old admiral who lived at Sholdean in the 18th century and amassed a large collection of Buddhas of various sizes and materials. When Mrs. Butt bought the property, she heard that it was haunted, and although she has often heard the knockings inseparable from certain psychic phenomena, and at times felt a cold wind suddenly rushing through one particular bedroom, she has never seen the ghost. This being so, she prefers to rely on the evidence of her own eyes and describe what she saw once for herself as an old house at St. Albans. Mrs. Butt's father was a native of the quaint, sleepy, historical town, famous during the War of the Roses on the account of the battle associated with its name. Like most young men, he fell in love, but with him it was a case of worshipping from afar, and as the only girl in the world was a boarder at a small finishing school, it was difficult to arrange any kind of personal meetings. The would-be suitor was a super romanticist, and as men's habit is to pursue distant things, he gradually built up a palace of imagination where he enshrined the object of his love, until the day when fate took a hand in the game and made their acquaintance possible. Afterwards, everything happened on the accepted lines of a fairy tale. The lovers married and lived happily until death parted them. As Mrs. Butt's father was a super romanticist, it is not surprising that anyone of this type should wish to purchase the house where his wife had passed her school days and where he had first seen her. This is what he did when the property which represented the romance of his life came into the market. His wife predeceased him, and when he too passed, he left certain property at St. Albans to his daughter, who decided to go there with the object of seeing what to retain and what to sell. The sisters thought they would first inspect the house associated with their parents' romance, and getting the keys from the solicitor acting for them, they proceeded to look over the house. There is nothing so pathetic as an empty house, especially when it has been vacant for some time. This tribute to sentiment had been unoccupied for years, and as the merciless sunlight pierced the coating of dirt on the windows and showed up many other defects, the sisters realized that a great deal of money would have to be spent in order to make the place attractive and habitable. They decided, romance or no romance, to dispose of it. Mrs. Butt, who wanted to explore the rooms on the first floor, left her sister in the one-time library and went upstairs. As she opened the drawing room door, she saw a gentleman standing by one of the tall windows. The stranger was youngish and good-looking, dressed in country clothes, and he gave Mrs. Butt the impression of being a professional man. Naturally, she wondered what had brought him there. Then, remembering that an agent was interested in the property, she concluded it must be him. Advancing, she held out her hand. "You've stolen a march on us," she said, "but I'm glad to see you, as now we can go thoroughly into the question of selling the house." To her amazement, there was no reply. The next moment, the figure disappeared, and the tall window space was vacant. At first, Mrs. Butt was too surprised to move. Then, realizing she had seen a return from another world, she ran quickly downstairs to find her sister in a state bordering on hysteria. "Let's get out of this dreadful house. At once," she sobbed. "It's haunted. I've seen the ghost." Mrs. Butt endeavored to calm and console the frightened woman, who gradually regained her self-control, told her sister that a man had walked through the library and disappeared in the opposite wall. "I couldn't have been mistaken," said she. "He was so natural-looking that I really thought it was someone who had come to see us on business. It was only after he vanished that I knew it was a ghost." When the sisters compared notes, they found that they had both seen the same figure. The story had a curious sequel. Some months later, when Mrs. Butt and her sister were looking over some of their mother's possession, they found the usual collection of old letters tied with faded ribbon, pressed flowers, family photographs, and fanciful knick-knacks belonging to the past. And Mrs. Butt casually picked up a packet of a dozen letters, sheltering a photograph in their midst. These letters were docketed. In the label, in their mother's handwriting, bore the inscription, "Love letters from Dr. T. when I was at school." Mrs. Butt untied the protecting ribbon, and as the photograph fell out, she recognized it as the original of the ghost in the empty house. Without saying a word, she handed the photograph to her sister, who exclaimed, "Why, that is the same man I saw at Mother's old school." The letters disclosed another romance. Mrs. Butt's father had not been the pretty school girl's only admirer. The writer, a well-known doctor at St. Albans, had likewise fallen in love with her, and Mrs. Butt found out afterwards he had died unmarried. This perfectly true story possesses a certain pathos, as featuring the most truest form of fidelity, which refuses to yield to time and triumphs over mortality and the grave. Mrs. Butt was never able to find out whether prior to her visit the house had the reputation of being haunted, or whether the manifestation had some special significance for herself and her sister. Perhaps the return may have been permitted to prove to these charming moderns that he is no lover who does not love forever. Battlefield. After the death of Mrs. Butt's father, she inherited certain properties in St. Albans, amongst which was another old house called Battlefield. And although it had been demolished to give place to a row of shops, I believe the original name has been retained. According to Mrs. Butt, Battlefield comprised part of the original battlefield, and it was well known that at times the sounds of galloping horses and the clash of swords and mail were plainly to be heard, although the ghostly soldiers never materialized. An extraordinary discovery was made in the kitchen of the house when a new floor was being laid down, as the ground suddenly subsided and disclosed a tunnel-like passage with a small chapel halfway down, in which were found various church vessels in good preservation, probably removed there for safety during the Wars of the Roses. Until the subsidence in the kitchen, the existence of the passage was unsuspected, and was afterward closed and not reopened when the house was finally pulled down. However, it is difficult to efface the power of the supernatural, and it is said that occasional hauntings persist, even on the modern battlefield, which covers the site of one of the landmarks of history in the days when every chance brought out a noble knight. Those who battled for the true, the just, and who have handed on that torch of patriotism throughout the centuries. Quakers Burying Ground, contributed by Miss Grace Webb. The period of these strange happenings was somewhere about 1863 to 1864, when my father, a lad of 15, was living with his father in the village of Sparleford, on the borders of Dorset and Somerset. Two of his cousins, young men of 19 and 20, and a friend, Larry by name, were then staying at the house, and Larry, a fine judge of horseflesh, had just broken in a mettlesome young mare that he proposed to sell at the local cattle and horse fair. On the evening of the horse fair, one of the cousins had promised to meet his sweetheart. I don't remember what the other one was doing on this particular night, but my father was asked to sit up and let in the horse dealer and the young man in love, who in all probability would be homing late. The two friends planned to return by the main road and to meet, where three roads converged at a little triangular enclosure known in the countryside as Quaker's Burying Ground. Many years previously, a temperamental Quaker who had committed suicide was buried here with a pointed stake driven through his heart. It was firmly believed that at certain times of the year the ghost walked, and superstitious pedestrians were careful to avoid Quaker's Burying Ground after nightfall, while those on horseback or a wheel invariably put on speed until they left it far behind. My father's cousin had not given a thought to the Quaker when he suggested the rendezvous, where he was due to arrive about 10:30. It was a cloudless, moonlight night, and as he walked briskly up the white ribbon of the road, he noticed someone apparently coming towards him, who made no appreciable progress. When he got nearer, he saw that the someone was a tall man in black, wearing a shovel hat, who disappeared into the hedge, groaning in rather an alarming manner. Youth is invariably suspicious, and Sam, rudely disturbed in love's young dreams, at once put down the groans and the figure as a practical joke staged by some would-be humorous friends. He leaped the hedge and promptly laid about him with his thick ash stick, but as the groan still continued, he proceeded to examine the length of the ditch for possibly bogged sheep. Finding nothing and still angry with the jokers who had disturbed his arrangements with Larry, he did not remember the story of the ghost until he had almost reached home, when it gradually dawned on him that he had met an uneasy return from another world. As soon as he saw my father, he announced impressively, "Bill, I've seen the Quaker." The sleepy lad did not much attach importance to Sam's further colorful revelations, inspired by cold beef, cheese, and good cider, until an hour later, when loud shouts proceeded from outside, and Larry, leading his once mettlesome mare, now a trembling, sweat-drenched creature, stumbled into the kitchen, exclaiming, "By God, Bill and Sam, I've seen the Quaker, and so has the mare." After comforting the trembling mare and settling her for the night in a roomy loose box, Sam returned to the house to find Larry in a state of collapse, from which he did not recover until given a stiff dose of brandy. He then explained what had happened. Close to the place where the figure had previously appeared to Sam, he had seen a man in black wearing a shovel hat walking towards him, who suddenly vanished with a loud groan behind a heap of stones at the figure of the road. The mare, who had evidently seen the figure, shied violently, snorted with fear, and absolutely refused to pass the heap of stones. For quite half an hour, neither spur nor coaxing had any effect on the mare, and Larry was forced to dismount and lead her all the way back. He told Bill and Sam that not for all the world's minted money would he go through another such experience. "There I was, trying to quiet the mare," he said, "hearing on and off horrible groans which turned my blood to water, wondering what I should see next, and not a soul in sight. The next time they bury one of those kinds of friends, I hope they'll plant him in some place where he can't upset people." Both my father and his cousin were able to testify to the condition of the mare and her rider, and as barely an hour before Sam had seen the Quaker's ghost, it can be assumed with some degree of certainty that neither had been mistaken nor acted in collusion. Sam and Larry were healthy, normal youths, unblessed with imagination, as well as being eminently practical, the horse dealer being especially distinguished for shrewdness and common sense. For what reason was this psychic phenomenon made manifest? It would be interesting to know whether it produced any lasting impression on those who witnessed it, and if so, of what nature. The young men always declared that they had seen the Quaker's ghost, and although my father never saw it, he followed the example of his elders and betters, and believed in it as thoroughly as George IV believed he had been present at the Battle of Waterloo and made such a sin of his memory to credit his own life. Three ghost stories contributed by the Honorable Mrs. Greville Nugent. The late Lady Vane's story of the ghost in the upper room. Some years ago, when the late Lady Vane and I were discussing the case for and against the supernatural, she suddenly said, "You see, Ermengarda, I must believe in the possibility of returns, as I actually came in contact with the earthbound spirit of a suicide when Sir Henry and I were staying at Ems." "A suicide?" "Yes, and an Englishman, more's the pity." Interested and intrigued, I begged Lady Vane to relate her experience, and here is the story, which she assured me was true in every detail. "At one time," said Lady Vane, "my husband and I occasionally went to Ems to take the waters in the far-off days when gambling was allowed at the various baths. This particular summer, we had engaged our rooms beforehand at the best hotel, but strange to say, although it was the height of the season, the bedroom over ours remained unoccupied when chance visitors, unable to find any accommodation, were being turned away. However, I thought no more about the empty room until one night when we were disturbed by the heavy footsteps of someone walking backwards and forwards overhead." "I suppose the room has been let," said Sir Henry, "but I hope whoever's walking about will soon go to bed." The restless visitor had not the slightest wish or intention of going to bed, and the ceaseless va-et-vient continued for quite an hour, till we were nearly driven mad. Then the footsteps ceased. "Thank heaven for small mercies," ejaculated by this time my thoroughly bad-tempered husband. All at once we heard the window thrown open with a bang, as if the occupant of the room was in a great hurry to let the cool, fresh air into the room. Afterwards, silence, deep and undisturbed, descended on us for the remainder of the night. "I hope you were not troubled again by the footsteps," I asked. "My dear, we suffered 3 nights' repetition of what we thought to be selfishness on the part of the sleep-preventing individual, until our nerves were worn thin, and on the fourth morning I questioned the floor waiter, who occupies the room above ours and makes so much noise at night." "Nadege Frage," said the man in expressionless voice, "the room above you is empty. You must have been mistaken." "Mistaken?" I cried. "How could I possibly mistake such ordinary sounds?" The man shrugged, made no answer, snatched up our breakfast trays, and hurried off. "I expect he's been well tipped by the person upstairs, to say nothing," I sighed. "However, I'll try Amalia, our bedchamber. Perhaps she will be more communicative." Amalia, of the lint white locks and Speedwell blue eyes, with a smile which invariably refused to come off, was more talkative than the floor waiter, and not only did she take her solemn oath that the room was empty, but she volunteered the information that it was also locked up. "So, Frau, it's clearly impossible for anyone to get inside, much less to walk about in it." Realizing that our cure was in danger of coming to an abrupt conclusion, and visualizing our precipitate return to England, I decided to have a heart-to-heart talk with the proprietor. And when this came off, I told him bluntly that we must change our rooms or leave the hotel. "It's no good putting us off with any more lies," roared Sir Henry, now all British, in this just quarrel. "It's a pretty state of things when English people abroad are treated like a lot of fools. If you have any reasonable explanation to offer for the secrecy and prevarication, I'm prepared to listen. But don't dare to say that Lady Vane and myself have dreamt we heard footsteps when we've scarcely been able to get a wink of sleep." I began to feel sorry for the apologetic, agitated proprietor, who, knowing by this time that frankness was the better part of discretion, begged us to come into his private office, "as I cannot run the risk of what I shall tell you being overheard," he said. Once in his office, with the door securely shut on possible eavesdropper, the bespectacled proprietor, who looked something like an angry owl, said, "The room is haunted." "Tosh!" ejaculated Sir Henry. "It is the truth. Once I, too, should have tosh said. But I understand I must now cease to let the room underneath the so noisy one upstairs. I asked the worried little German to explain himself, and after a long prelude, he eventually told us that 5 years previously an Englishman, young, rich, and well-born, had occupied the upstairs room for several weeks. His reason for coming to M's was not to be cured of any bodily ailment, the cure for his particular complaint being an impossibility. He was a born gambler who played for high stakes, and he alternately won and lost. Afterwards, he lost all day and every day, until one night he returned from the casino a ruined man. We were sorry for the disaster to this never-to-be-forgotten so charming young man, but when I went upstairs to offer my respectful sympathy, he had locked his door. I heard him pacing to and fro, so I did not disturb him. But God in Himmel, hardly had I gone to bed than people began to shout in the street. Then we were called by the police, and when I came down to see what was the matter, imagine my horror to hear that the Englishman had thrown himself out of the bedroom window and had been killed instantly. Afterwards, there were complaints from visitors who slept in the room, who insisted that someone walked to and fro in the darkness. So I closed it, and I never let it again. It seems, however, that the spirit of this suicide cannot rest, especially at the time of the year when he put an end to his life. It is almost the month, so I will offer the Hotchborn, sir and lady, better rooms in another part of my hotel, while praying them not to mention this disastrous affair to their friends. We promised to say nothing, changed our room for the better, and completed our cure. But there is no doubt whatever in my mind as to the reality of my ghostly experience. The late Lady Strickland's experience of Place Urich. So much for Lady Vane's story. As supernatural history often repeats itself, my own ghost story is also connected with footsteps. In the summer of 1892, I was staying with my friends, the late Lady Strickland, at an old manor house called Place Urich, near Fowelly. I was the only visitor, and one night Lady Strickland and I sat up so late playing cards that it was long past midnight when we prepared to go to bed. In view of what happened, I should mention that the servants at Place Urich, who had all gone to bed long before, slept in another wing, and as they used the back staircase to go to their rooms, no one but ourselves could possibly be using the front staircase at that hour. The old house was in absolute stillness, and the moonlight lay in pools of silver on the oak staircase. My bedroom on the first floor faced the landing, and Lady Strickland, who slept on the floor above me, was just in the act of lighting her candle from mine when we heard heavy footsteps coming upstairs from the hall. The steps were slow and hesitatingly, apparently those of an old man, and they were accompanied by the sound of labored breathing, punctuated by various degrees of coughing. We exclaimed simultaneously, "Who's that coming upstairs?" There was no reply. We looked over the balusters, but although the coughing and wheezing came nearer and nearer, we saw no one. By this time we were too scared to move. Our candlesticks fell to the ground, and we clung to each other in fear of the unknown. The steps paused for a moment beside us, as if the unseen owner of the feet had stopped to take breath. He then continued his upward progress until the coughing gradually died away and we heard no more. I implored my hostess not to go up to her bedroom, but to share mine or any other on the first floor, but she refused, saying, "I have some holy water in my room, and with spiritual protection I fear nothing." Next morning, when we compared notes, we found that neither of us had heard any more footsteps and had not been disturbed in any way. So ended my ghost story. But some weeks later, after my return to England, I received a letter from Lady Strickland. "After you left," she wrote, "I made cautious inquiries in the neighborhood, and imagine what I've discovered. It appears that at the end of the last century, the manor house was occupied by an old reprobate squire who drank himself to death, and whose deathbed horrors seem to have been something unthinkable. It is said that his earthbound spirit occasionally revisits his home, vainly trying to obtain some gratification for his ceaseless thirst, so we were evidently favored with one of his periodical returns." This explanation interested me greatly, but let me admit I am thankful I never saw, but only heard, what would doubtless have been a very dreadful psychic phenomena, had it been permitted to materialize. the Dun Cow of Warwick. My last authentic ghost story is from the famous Dun Cow of Warwick. The legend is well known. It can be found in any topographical history of Warwick, dealing with the days of the semi-legendary hero Sir Guy of Warwick. This ghost story was told me and vouched for by the late Dowager Marchioness of Danshire, a relation of the Greville family, when I was staying at East Hampstead Park in 1889. Lady Danshire said that when she and Lord Danshire were on a visit to Warwick Castle, I forget in what year, the then Lady Warwick mentioned casually that fresh turf had been laid down on a grass plot under the windows of the rooms allotted to the Downshires. And she added, "I hope no one will walk on it till it has taken good root." It was glorious summer weather, and when Lady Downshire, who was feeling the heat oppressive, got up at dawn to open the window, she saw, to her astonishment, a dun-colored cow trampling over the newly laid turf. She roused Lord Downshire, and they both leant out and tried to shoo away the heavy-hoofed intruder, who took not the slightest notice of their united commands to keep off the grass. "Must have escaped from a herd in the park," said Lord Downshire, preparatory to resuming his interrupted slumbers. "But won't Lady Warwick be furious when she finds the turf ruined, as it's bound to be after that uprooting? Damn carelessness, I call it." Judge for yourself Lady Danshire's feelings when next morning no hoof marks were visible, and the lovely turf sparkling with dew was unspoiled. At breakfast, which represents the one meal of the day relegated to bills and general unpleasantness, which in my opinion should always be partaken alone, Lady Downshire, knowing nothing of the legend that the Dun Cow always appeared before death in the Warwick family, innocently related her experience, backed up by her husband's evidence. Lord Downshire, who was still difficult from loss of sleep, enlarged rather forcibly on the occurrence due to the carelessness of those who allowed dun cows to go astray, regardless of Lady Warwick's frantic pantomime signifying stop at once. And he could not understand why unrelieved gloom fell on the breakfast table. Afterwards, Lady Warwick confided to Lady Downshire that she had seen the spectral cow, "and you will hear very shortly that one or another of us has passed away," said her tearful hostess. Her words proved only too true. A few weeks later, Lord Warwick died. My Two Meetings with the Ghost of a Dead Man on the Folkestone Road by Maud Folks. These supernatural experiences happened to me in the summer of 1925 and the new year of 1928, and they are corroborated by reliable witnesses who, if they do not believe in the reality of returns, are sufficiently fair-minded not to dispute facts, which even their unimaginative common sense still puts down as very odd. As for myself, I offer no explanation beyond stating what actually occurred, and I shall always believe that on two separate occurrences I met the ghost of the late Mr. Alfred Lewis on the Folkestone Road. Alfred Lewis, the original of Daniel Deronda and the Old Man of Visions, was one of the most extraordinary personalities I've ever met, and as such merits an introduction in this true ghost story. I owed my friendship with him to Algernon Blackwood, who brought him to see me in 1908, and not only was I impressed by the atmosphere of tragedy which enveloped the frail old man, but I had never heard beautiful thoughts so beautifully expressed as by this dreamer of dreams, who was so far above the sordid happenings of life. At one time, Alfred Lewis was well known in political and literary circles. It is said that his family, Jewish and proud of it, came from the Midlands. He had a distinguished career at Cambridge and was called to the bar, his intense desire to enter Parliament being thwarted by Gladstone. He shook the dust of England off his feet and went to New Zealand, afterwards to India. Returning to England, he hid himself from public life. Algernon Blackwood first met Alfred Lewis in New York. He was then living in an attic, producing occasional poems of singular beauty. To money and the rewards of this world, he was divinely indifferent, and Algernon Blackwood remembers him rising at dawn, walking the streets in a shabby frock coat, tieless, wearing the oldest boots, conscious only of the eternal verities. His conversation was marvelous, his memory never at fault, his power of quotation superb, according to Algernon Blackwood. Here was the wreck of a big intellect, and it was intensely sad. He spoke little of his past, but the passion, the sacrifice, the resignation of his poetry betrayed him. Algernon Blackwood can testify to Alfred Lewis's exquisite speaking voice, which I heard during his life, and later, outre tombe. In writing of him, the famous author says, "When I knew him, his aloofness from the sordid side of human life, his loftiness of outlook, his stern and icy morality, his intense and acute tenderness for others, all amounted very nearly to that state of being out of relationship to environment. But everybody loved him, and he loved everybody. He had been intimate with George Eliot, a frequent visitor to her house, where Lou, Spencer, and Huxley were of the party. Manning was also his friend, Longfellow more than a friend. He came back to England from New York through a friend of Algernon Blackwood's, who had decided to settle in England and who had been instructed in English law by Alfred Lewis, who remained in England until his passing. Mr. Lewis once sent me some stanzas with a little memo. A.H.L. feels deeply the appreciation of Mrs. F.F. And before me as I write is a faded sheet of paper covered with tremulous fine characters, heart-rending sonnet hereafter. I heard that Mr. Lewis had passed over from Algernon Blackwood, and how the last clouded years had been made free from material anxieties by the kindness of the American friend of his New York days. We had not met for some time, and had certainly not been thinking of him on the day when I overtook him on the Folkestone Road. One afternoon in July 1925, I was motoring from London to Sandgate with my friend Elizabeth Broad. I had hired the car from William Ludlow of Sandgate, who at that time often took me backwards and forwards to town. I mention this to show there was nothing out of the ordinary, either in connection with those who had shared the experience or the reason for the journey. On this afternoon of afternoons, there were fewer pedestrians and not much traffic on the road. I was comfortably tired, not paying much attention to things around me, and we were well out of London, when the car gradually overtook a solitary individual dressed in black, walking slowly in the footpath on the near side of the car. All at once the incoming tide from the sea of distant memories flowed over my soul. There was something familiar about this figure in black. Where had I seen it before? As we approached it nearer, I saw an old man, wearing a frock coat of an antiquated cut, black trousers, a silk hat, and most incongruously, evening pumps. For the moment, my heart stood still. In this individual, I recognized Alfred Lewis. Yet, it couldn't be. My friend was dead, but it was impossible to mistake the eccentric ensemble which, during his lifetime, had made him noticeable alike in the reading room of the British Museum and the streets of London. I looked and looked again, until common sense urged me to pass by on the other side. This I did, saying to myself, moral coward that I was, it could never be Mr. Lewis. No sooner had I left the figure behind than a belated sense of self-respect made me return. I said to Ludlow, "Go back and tell the person we passed a few minutes ago that I should like to speak to him." Ludlow, accustomed to my impulsive ways, stopped the car and returned with Mr. Lewis. It was surely none other than Mr. Lewis, and my last doubts were swept away when I heard the magic of his unforgettable voice. I don't know how I contrived to speak in an ordinary manner. "You look very tired," I said. "Will you let me offer you a lift?" The familiar, kind eyes looked at me. "Willingly." "I'm going a little way beyond Maidstone," replied Mr. Lewis. We were then about 30 miles distant from Maidstone. "Why, you cannot possibly walk all that way," I cried. "Oh, yes," he said gently. There was no mutual recognition, no explanations. After all, how could there be? It seemed quite natural for us to meet again. Inside the car, Mr. Lewis sat next to Ludlow. He carried a small attaché case, nothing else, and we continued our way under the spell of a peculiar stillness, representing something of the peace of an immortal hour. At last, "Have you come far?" I asked. He smiled. "A long distance. I've brought the key of my home with me," and opening the attaché case, Mr. Lewis took out a large rusty key that didn't look as if it had been made for a door. It was more suitable for an entrance gate. We talked little and casually. At the time, I was so astonished that I cannot remember much of our conversation. but I gathered he had come for some special reason. I knew subconsciously that I was expected to understand, to make no comments, and to accept this fantastic happening for a wise purpose. It is impossible to describe the psychical impression of this amazing journey. As I sat immediately behind Mr. Lewis, I could see every detail of the familiar personality, the shiningness of his tightly buttoned frock coat, the seams showing rusty greens, the white elastic bands which kept the patent leather pumps on his small feet, the way his beard rippled, the curious resemblance to the prophets of old depicted in the Sistine Chapel by Michelangelo. I longed to say, "I know you. You know me. Tell me something of yourself." But how on earth could I do so? "We reached Maidstone about 5, I said. "Let me know where I can put you down." He replied, with that old-world courtesy so peculiarly his own, that, as his destination lay some miles on the other side of Maidstone, he would not take me out of my way. He would leave us here. I refused to listen. "I'll not let you walk another step." We skirted Maidstone and were soon lost in tree-bordered roads and the dreaming silence of the countryside. The sun was far in the western skies. The hour was incredibly lonely. It seemed a little cold. When the car reached the spot where a weather-worn signpost showed 4 roads diverging from its ancient arms, Mr. Lewis told Lolo to stop. "My way lies here," he said, pointing to a stretch of meadowland. To me, he said, "Do not forget our meeting." "Then you know," I cried. He smiled, crossed the road, opened the meadow gate, and the sunlight took him to itself. He became unreal, a golden figure lapped by waves of dying fire. Then he was lost to sight. Whither, O whither goest thou? Bill Ludlow, the sailor man, who had laughed at danger in the North Sea during the war, was the first to speak. "Well, I'm blessed," he said. "Whoever was that gentleman?" A few evenings later, I dined with a Ralph Phillipsons at Encombe. Algernon Blackwood was staying there. Encombe was the only English environment save one in which I have not felt an outsize. And an outsider, perhaps not an outsider in the usual accepted sense, but someone who always stood outside the social world. I knew I should not be laughed at or held politely down when I described my meeting with old Mr. Lewis. My story was accepted quite naturally, with a proviso from Ralph Phillipson that it would be interesting to know whether anyone answering the description of Mr. Lewis had gone to the Hop Gardens as a lay preacher. It's difficult to explain the resemblance, but it may have been someone well known by the hop pickers, said Ralph. We made inquiries, discovered nothing, and save for its memory, the incident was closed. An anticlimax in fiction is a daring experiment. This story is not fiction, and an anticlimax is necessary. One morning in the new year of 1928, I was motoring towards London when I suddenly came on Mr. Lewis in almost the identical place where I had first seen him. At this period, I was storm-tossed, entirely disenchanted. To me, the sight of this serene figure meant spiritual safety. I think he was waiting for me. I stopped the car and walked up to him. I said, "I knew all the time who you were. Oh, Mr. Lewis, tell me, where are you going?" He indicated the high road. "My mission lies in many places." "Oh, let me come with you," I begged. "I'm so unhappy." "Not yet," he answered. "At present, you must take your road alone." And raising his hand in blessing, he left me. I've never seen Mr. Lewis again, and I've described what actually happened as dispassionately as possible. I can never forget Alfred Lewis, and his memory is one of the tender thoughts which serve to soften my heart when it hardens towards life, for it is impossible to recall him without feeling that he suffered many things uncomplainingly, and his patience and tenderness under affliction were in the nature of a martyrdom. There is no doubt that some kind of a tragedy had darkened his life. The late Canon Hartford and Archbishop Benson, who knew the whole story, never betrayed it. All that I have written concerning these strange meetings on the highway is true. Explain it or deny it as you will. The Farrier of Sablon, a true ghost story of the reign of Louis XIV, vouched for by the Duc de Saint-Simon and his reminiscences. Somewhere in the August of 1698-99, a wonderful instance of supernatural guidance set Versailles agog, and as it concerned no less a person than Louis XIV, it deserves to be included in True Ghost Stories from France. One day, a man wearing the coarse cloths and leather apron of a farrier, hailing from the little town of Sablon in Provence, arrived at Versailles and demanded to see the king in private. It is easy to understand the amusement which this modest request created, but heedless of the laughter and rebuffs which met him on every side, the farrier persisted in his pressing request to speak to his majesty. Louis had means of his own of knowing all that transpired around him, so it was not long before the farrier of Sablon was told that the king was not accustomed to grant audiences to whomsoever chose to ask for him. This personal message would have made the majority of people fade out as soon as possible. Not so the farrier, who declared that if he were to see his majesty, he would tell him things so secret and so unknown to everyone that the king would absolutely be convinced of their importance. If his majesty still refuses to speak with me, let me be sent to a minister of state, said the obstinate peasant. Upon hearing this, the king, who invariably preserved an open mind, arranged for the farrier to interview Barbizot, one of his private secretaries, not dreaming that the visitor's psychic intuition would enable him to know that Barbizot was no minister, but a mere secretary, and as such of no value whatever. This proof that the farrier was indeed someone out of the common made Louis hand him over to Monsieur Pompon, who certainly filled the bill in a ministerial capacity. This is a story which the farrier told the Minister of State at Versailles, after every precaution had been taken to prevent the possibility of palace walls possessing ears. I was returning home late one evening, said the man. My way lay through a wood, and I suddenly found myself surrounded by a great light. In the midst of this, monsieur, stood a lady whom I knew to be even higher in rank than an aristocrat. This lady called me by my name and spoke to me for more than half an hour. Proceed, said Monsieur Pompon, which hardly concealed lazy indifference. The lady told me that she was the queen who had been the wife of his majesty and who died in 1683. Monsieur Pompon lifted his eyebrows. This fellow possessed audacity. To dare to look at a queen's ghost, much less to talk to it, was unheard of. The farrier appreciated Monsieur Pompon's hostile attitude, but entirely unaffected, he continued. The queen ordered me to go to Versailles and report to his majesty all she had communicated to me, especially one secret thing, known only to the king, which would convince him of the truth of what I had to say. The queen added that if I could not see the king in person, I was to speak to a minister of state, telling him certain important things, reserving others for his majesty alone. If you do not set out at once, she added, you will most assuredly be punished with death. Well spoken, my good fellow, said the minister, but it savors not of the late queen's disposition. She was, God rest her soul, never in favor of extreme measures. I promised to obey her in everything, replied the farrier, and the next moment I found myself in complete darkness near a large tree. I wanted to think over what had happened, so I spent the night in the wood, but I did not know whether I was awake or asleep. In the morning I went to work, convinced that what I had seen was a delusion, and you may be sure I kept my tongue well between my teeth at Sablon. Why not equally so at Versailles, yawned Monsieur Pompon? Because, monsieur. 2 days later I saw her late majesty again. She addressed me in the same terms and told me to go at once to the intendant of the province, who would furnish me with money after I had told him with whom I had spoken. A little improbable. If you had been in my place, monsieur, you would not have known what to do for the best. I did not dare confide in anyone, so I left things alone for 8 days, and then I decided to do nothing more. But her late majesty thought otherwise. You say that she was not in favor of punishment? Well, she must have changed greatly since she died. She was so angry that my one idea was to get to Versailles as quickly as possible. I left the forge to take care of itself, and 2 days afterwards I saw our intendant at Aix, who listened to me and gave me sufficient money to travel by a public conveyance. The intendant's attitude in carrying out the dead queen's wishes carried weight, and the unbelieving minister began to take things more seriously. The farrier had three interviews with Monsieur Pompon, each of 2 hours' duration, and an account of these was rendered privately to the king, who ordered Monsieur Pompon to discuss the question in a special council composed of the Dukes of Beauvais, Pontchartrain, and Torcy. Monseigneur alone was excluded. After a lengthy sitting, the council dispersed, and the farrier of Sablon was sent for to converse with the Sun King in the privacy of his cabinet. 2 days later, Louis saw the man again, and each time the king spent more than an hour with him. Moreover, special precautions were taken to make sure that no one was within hearing. The morning after the first interview, the king, dressed for hunting, was descending the great staircase when Monsieur Duras, one of his few intimates, whose relations with royalty were evidently something like those of the Prince Regent and Beau Brummel, began to speak contemptuously of the farrier, and he went so far as to quote the proverb that the man was mad or the king was not noble. Louis XIV stopped on the staircase, looked at Monsieur Duras up and down, and said coldly, "If that be so, then I am not noble, for I have discoursed with him long, and he has spoken to me with much good sense. I assure you he is far from being mad." These words were pronounced so gravely, with so much emphasis, that silence fell on the king's entourage. It was afterwards agreed here indeed was a whole time mystery to intrigue the court. Louis XIV allowed this world to know that his second interview with the fairy had absolutely convinced him that the man's uncanny knowledge could only have been derived from personal communication with the spirit of the queen, as he knew of an occurrence which had happened in the forest of Saint Germain 20 years previously, about which the king had never breathed a word to anyone. The king invariably spoke highly of this particular village blacksmith, and not only did he pay all the expenses which he had incurred, but he gave him a gratuity, and desired the intent of Ox to take particular care of his protege, and never to let him want for anything during his lifetime. The surprising thing about this surprising story is that none of the ministers in council could be induced to speak a word about the important revelations of the farrier. Their friends questioned them in vain. The farrier was as silent as the grave. All that could be extracted from him was that he was not allowed to speak. He was about 50 years of age, somewhat of a rough diamond, a typical provincial, an excellent blacksmith, and when he returned to Sablon, he never boasted of his interview with the Grand Monarch, slipping back to his work as if nothing out of the way had happened, and the ghost of Marie Therese never appeared to him again. Such is a true story which filled the French court with astonishment, and which nobody has ever understood. Some people persuade themselves that the farrier had been the dupe of a certain Madame Arnoul, but as the honest man knew nobody outside his own village, this idea was dismissed as absurd and impractical. Why, then, did the phantom of a queen of France choose such a humble mouthpiece? It may be argued that, if she had fixed on any person at court, or anyone moving in the Parisian society, their disclosures would have been somewhat in the nature of tainted evidence, hence her selection of a simple man whose life was above suspicion of any intrigues. The truth of the story has never been arrived at. The Duc de Saint-Simon gives it in detail and in all sincerity. Louis XIV confirmed the farrier's knowledge of a secret known only to himself. The ministers of state received the farrier's messages with conviction and allowed no details to pass beyond the council chamber. But after the lapse of nearly 250 years, one cannot help wondering what it was that the Queen of France told the farrier of Sablon. The mere mention of Versailles opens up tremendous ghostly possibilities, especially as most parts of it are well known to be haunted. The great echoing palace has seen more tragedies and more pulsating life stories than most royal residences, and in 1720, Madame the Princess Palatine, Louis XIV's outspoken sister-in-law, relates one of the earliest recorded ghost stories of Versailles. Madame, a pleasant-looking, stout little woman, utterly devoid of imagination, German to the last drop of her blood, had no use for and no belief in ghosts. We people of the Palatinate never see ghosts or dream dreams, she said, and yet in all seriousness she gave the world, in her famous letters, three true stories of the supernatural. On November 14, 1720, Madame wrote to Monsieur de Harling. The Queen's mother had a lodging made for herself above the gallery at Fontainebleau, and her chamber women had to pass the night in the long gallery. They say that they had seen King Francis walking about, clad in a green flowered dressing gown, but he never did me the honor of showing himself to me. I don't think I can be popular with ghosts, because I slept for 10 years in a room in which the late Madame died, and I was never able to see anything. But the first time that the Dauphin slept there, his aunt, the late Madame, appeared to him. He told me about it himself. One night, after he had gone to bed, he heard the door leading to the drawing room open. That evening, a great ball had been given in the drawing room, and he saw a beautifully dressed woman coming in, wearing a blue overdress, a lovely yellow petticoat, and many yellow ribbons in her hair. Her head was turned towards the window, and the Dauphin, who thought it was a young Duchess de Foix, coughed in order to make her glance in his direction. The lady did so, but instead of the Duchess de Foix, it was the late Madame, whom he saw before him, just as he had seen her for the last time before her death. He was so frightened that he awoken the Dauphiness. "What has happened?" she asked. "I'll tell you tomorrow," he replied. The Dauphin maintained throughout his life that this story was true. Another first-hand ghost story was told the Palatine by Comtesse de Fürstenberg, after the latter had confessed to her friend that she could not bear to be alone because she was afraid of ghosts. The matter-of-fact Palatine laughed. "Like you, I should probably have thought it funny," said the Comtesse rather sharply, "if I had not seen a ghost." She then proceeded to say how in the days of her youth, a certain Comte de Ruberta, whose people were trying to force him to marry a de Fustenberg, was in love with her, and in order to avoid a distasteful marriage, the Count determined to go to war. Before leaving Germany, he had his horoscope cast, which foretold that if he saw active service, the first shot fired in the field of battle would be for him and would kill him. "He came to me," said the Countess, "and promised if he were killed, he would return to say goodbye. He also asked me if I should be frightened. I would much rather see you living than as a ghost," I replied. "Come," said he, "give me your hand and promise you will not be frightened." And, as I thought he was only teasing me, I gave him my hand. Sometime later, he joined his regiment. It was summer, and one night I could not sleep. So I got up and, seated by a table, resting my head on my hands, I dropped into an uneasy doze. Suddenly I heard a noise in the corridor, as of someone walking in spurred boots. "Who can be coming so early?" And turning my head, I saw a figure in brown, which disappeared immediately. It was impossible to distinguish the face, but its general appearance was that of Ruberta. I started to scream, and as I did so, an invisible hand gave me a sharp blow. The first news that the Countess received from the front was the death of Ruberta. And when she asked her informant what clothes he was wearing, she was told that he was clad in brown just as she had seen him. It also transpired he was killed at the very moment when his ghost appeared to the Countess. Now for the third story. It seems that a certain Princess de Ragotasi, another friend of Madame's, died suddenly after the extraction of a tooth, following the indiscriminate system of bleeding then in vogue. And after her death, the prince's servants told Madame an extraordinary experience which their late mistress had at Warsaw previous to her arrival in Paris. One night the princess dreamt that a stranger came to speak to her in a little room that she had never seen before and offered her a glass of water, telling her to drink. As she was not thirsty, she refused. "This will be your last drink," said the stranger, and at this moment the princess awoke. The dream made a great impression on her, and when she came to Paris and her friends recommended the king's doctor as her medical man, Dr. Helvetius, who was Dutch and a clever and charming individual, could not understand his patient's obvious distress when she first saw him. This, after all, had he but known it, was quite understandable, as Dr. Helvetius reproduced feature by feature the dream man the princess had seen at Warsaw. Then she laughed. "After all," said the princess, "I shall not die, because this room is not in the least like the one I saw." At that time, it was customary for great ladies to live at aristocratic convents, and as the convent at Chaillot was in the fashion, Princess de Ragazzi decided to stay there for a time. On her arrival, when she was shown the bedroom prepared for her, she said very quietly, "I shall never leave here alive. This is the room I saw. In here I shall drink for the last time." In the course of a few weeks, the dream was fulfilled when Dr. Avaltius handed the dying woman a glass of water. In concluding the account of her friend's death, Madame, worried and perplexed by something out of the ordinary, demands, "What is the reason of it?" And with immense philosophy, she answers her question by saying quite simply, "God knows." So much for these scattered stories from Versailles. But there must be others. The King Ferdinand of Bulgaria once described the town as one of the most haunted in Europe. A few years ago, two serious-minded ladies published an account of a supernatural adventure which befell them at the Trianon, when yesterday was called back and they saw time return. I often wonder whether the race of the Du Barry linger in Lucien's. If so, she may not be alone, and perhaps the Duc de Brissac, the great lover and gallant gentleman whose severed head is buried in some unknown spot at Lucien's, bears her company. But I hope Jean's return is not as the poor creature, wild with terror, who begged Monsieur Le Bureau to give her 1 minute more, but rather as the charming exile from court, happy in her enchanted retreat, the woman to whom the Brissac wrote, "I love you," and for life.